Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, Professor William Cooper examines the idea of honor in the antebellum South. Professor Cooper explains how a person's honor was significantly defined by public perception, and for a gentleman, any perceived slight of a person's honor demanded defense, usually through a duel. This hour-long class took place at Louisiana State University.
This morning, we're going to talk about the code, or the code of honor. And if you've read Oda Verbena, you know exactly what I'm talking about. What I want to do today is to investigate a part of Southern attitude and mentality was critical to the way antebellum Southerners thought and the way antebellum Southerners acted. I want to start with two words, honor and independence or liberty. Honor won independence or liberty. Now today, honor is an empty word. It's not even a civic virtue anymore. But in the antebellum South, no concept was more powerful than honor. It combined respect, esteem, reputation. All of you know what respect means, you know what esteem means, you know what reputation means. Roll those all together. That's what honor meant. The second word is independence or liberty, synonyms, independence or liberty. And what I want to emphasize about this independence, it is the exact opposite of dependence. If you're independent, you're not dependent. An honorable person in the antebellum South was an independent person. A person with liberty. An independent person, a person with liberty, was an honorable person. Now remember, this is in the context of a slave society. A slave was dependent. A slave did not have liberty. A slave, by definition, had no honor in terms as the whites saw it. Now think of the cultural impact of this. No white person wanted to be equated with a slave or with slave-like characteristics. Thus, this honor, this code, becomes critical for mores. Honor, reputation, esteem, respect becomes mandatory for an individual who does not want to be deemed slave-like. There are two dimensions, and this is really critical. There are two dimensions of this code, to this concept of honor. First is internal. No person wants to believe himself less than honorable. Every person wants to think, I say himself because we're mostly involved with men here, but every person wants to think that he's an honorable person, he's an independent person. But there is also a second dimension to this. There's an external dimension. Now, oftentimes, even in our own time, people will say, well, I know I'm right. I know I'm a decent person. And I don't give a rip what everybody else thinks. That wouldn't cut it in the antebellum South. Not at all. Because the external dimension was critically important. It was crucial that the community also perceived you as an honorable person. Not just you in your own mind, your own heart, you believed it. The community had to perceive it. The community knew what slave characteristics meant, and a person who had slave characteristics was a person who had been shamed, who was covered in shame, not in honor, not at all. Let me try to make this point directly. Andrew Jackson, all of you know his name, though we haven't really talked about him yet. He was a famous general, became president of the United States. He was also a slave owner. Andrew Jackson, on one occasion, said slanderers were worse than murderers. Now, how in the world can you think of a slanderer as worse than a murderer? In our time, that just makes no sense at all. It makes no sense. It's senseless to say a slanderer is worse than a murderer. But for Jackson, a slanderer was worse because he said, a murderer only takes your life. A slanderer takes your good name. Without your good name, you don't have a life. You're a living dead man as far as Jackson was concerned. Now, think about Oda Verbena, which I asked you to read, Faulkner's story. The young protagonist, Bayard Sawyris, has to decide what to do upon hearing of his father's death. His father had been shot. Bayard makes up his own mind about what he's going to do. But he also knows he must act in a way that the community respects what he does. And if you've read the story, you know in the beginning, Drusilla, the young widow of his father, Drusilla is unhappy with Bayard. But at the end of the story, she puts a sprig of verbena on his pillow to indicate to him, because in the story, the smell of verbena is a smell of courage, to indicate to him that, yes, she too had finally come to understand what he had done, that what he had done merited her respect. He had acted in an honorable fashion. He had followed the code. Now, are there any questions or comments at all thus far? Anything? This is just the meaning. Just the meaning. Now, what I want to try to do for the rest of the time is give concreteness to what I've started out with. Give concreteness to it. Now, there has to be a social manifestation. This code doesn't carry any weight unless there's a social manifestation. It has to be out in the public. People have to know about it. People have to see you acting it out. It requires the public display of a private quality. The public display of a private quality. Again, to repeat, simply to have a private quality does not suffice. There has to be a public display. The most dramatic form of this is a duel. The duel. Now, where did the duel come from? The duel came to the United States during the Revolutionary War. It came with continental officers who came to fight over here. Remember, the Germans came to fight with the British. The French came to fight with the Americans. And it stayed behind after those German and French officers had left to go back to Europe. At the outset, the duel was certainly not sectional. And without any question, the most famous duel in American history took place across the Hudson River from New York City in 1804. Alexander Hamilton fought Aaron Burr. Burr at the time was the sitting Vice President of the United States. In this duel, as you all know, Aaron Burr killed Alexander Hamilton. In the aftermath of the Burr-Hamilton duel, states began to pass laws outlawing duels. Southern states as well. Southern states passed laws outlawing duels, and the laws would proscribe people convicted of dueling. You couldn't hold office. Other kinds of penalties would be handed down to you. Now, how do we assess the effectiveness of these anti-dueling laws? You all know that just because a law is passed doesn't mean it's enforced. After all, in Louisiana, you're not supposed to be able to drink unless you're 21 years old. I'm sure none of you has ever touched a drop of anything spiritual like that before you became 21, and those of you who aren't yet 21, I'm sure you've never done so. You know, laws are laws. So how do we go about trying to decide the importance of this law, the impact of it? Well, there were no Gallup polls from the middle of the 19th century. We don't have any numbers to find out exactly. Nobody went around asking, well, what do you think of this law? Nothing like that. But I think there are ways we can approach finding out. In fact, I think there are three ways we can look at it to find out. First, what is the reaction to these laws? And when you look at the reaction to these laws, what you notice, first of all, is the offenders lost no status. Those who did duel and people knew about their dueling lost no status. I'll give you two examples. First, Alabama had an anti-dueling law, and part of the law said that if you fought a duel, you could not hold public office. In the early 1840s, an Alabama congressman fought a duel. He was in Washington, the Congress. The duel was fought in Maryland. Everybody knew about this in Alabama. So what did the Alabama legislature do? It quickly passed a resolution exempting this particular congressman from the law. In other words, it waived the law for him. Didn't matter. First example. Second example, what duelists often did, and you'll see this a little bit later this morning, would cross a state line. There's a law against dueling in Alabama, so you just cross the line and fight in Georgia. Or if you're any dueling law in Tennessee, you cross the line and fight in Kentucky. Well, if you do that, you don't violate the law of Tennessee because you don't fight a duel in Tennessee. You don't violate the law of South Carolina because you fight a duel in Georgia. Now, people know you've done this, but you haven't violated the law, technically. So, and there's no loss of status. No loss of status at all. So the first thing is, the reaction of the laws shows clearly that there's no loss of status to offenders. The second thing to look at is the public recognition. And it really follows from what I've been saying, because the public knew about these occasions. But to make it even more clear, in 1838, a man named John L. Wilson, who had been a governor of South Carolina, wrote a book. The book was entitled The Code of Honor. And you know I've got the ellipses here because it's one of these 19th century titles that take the whole board up if I wrote the whole title up. Now, what is this book? It's not a thick book. It's really I should really call it more of a pamphlet than a book. It is an etiquette book. It's a rule book that tells you what you do when you fight duels. It tells you how you go about it. It tells you who's to be involved. Somebody does something that offends you, you call a friend of yours in, and this friend is known as the second. You tell this second, this friend, that that person has offended you. So the second goes to the person and says, look, what you said, wrote, offends my friend. You apologize, or we expect to have the satisfaction of a gentleman. Now, I'm here, this comes to me, what do I do? I say, oh my gosh, I didn't really mean to say that. I apologize absolutely. Well, maybe you really didn't mean to say it, but you can say, well, I didn't mean to say it in quite that way, and I can use these words, will that satisfy? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Or you might say, I certainly did mean it. He will get his satisfaction. And then a duel is arranged. But you see, the duel is usually not arranged between the two principals, the seconds who come in. And we'll see how this happens in a specific example in a few minutes. Seconds come in to do that, to do the actual arranging of the duel. And again, I want to emphasize, John L. Wilson was just not somebody, some pro-violence crank around a corner someplace. He was a prominent citizen. He had been a governor of a state. And he thought dueling was absolutely critical to maintain civilized manners. He says, if you have to put your life on the line, you'll be careful about what you say. You will act in a civilized measure. So violence is necessary, the threat of violence is necessary to maintain civilization if you want to go that far. But this is Wilson's point. Now that's second, the public recognition. And you notice with the seconds involved, it's not just the one who offends and the one who is offended. Other people get involved. Others get involved. So there are always several individuals involved in a particular incident, not just the two people who are at the front of the thing. The third way you can look at this, look at the stature of those involved in duels. Now, duels aren't fought by fellows who get drunk in some barroom, though that did happen too in a way, on Saturday night. Duels are fought by people who think about what they're doing, and duels are fought by people at the top of society. I've already mentioned Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was a famous duelist. And in 1826, just to underscore that people at the top of the ladder involved in duels, a duel was fought between a sitting United States senator and the Secretary of State of the United States. These two men fought a duel. Now, the fact that you've got politicians involved in duels shouldn't be surprising. And in fact, most of the duels that are recorded are fought between either politicians or newspaper editors. And why? Because what they say is out in the public. The public knows what they say. And it's this whole public-private thing that's so critical to this Southern Code. It's the whole public-private thing that's so critical. Well, you look at reaction to the laws, you look at public recognition, you look at the stature of those involved, you add those three together. Clearly, the laws against dueling did not come close to stopping the duel. Now, were there those in the South who opposed the duel? Absolutely. Most clergymen spoke vigorously against it. And yet, those who spoke against the duel never really had any significant impact. The duel never disappeared from antebellum life. It never disappeared. The force was simply too powerful. The force of the code was simply too powerful. Remember what Andrew Jackson's quotation, that a slanderer is worse than a murderer. Well, let me give you another example. In the early 19th century, a rising young Kentucky politician, a man in the next part of the course, you'll learn his name. His name was Henry Clay. In fact, Clay was the Secretary of State who was involved in the duel I mentioned a few minutes ago. Well, Clay fought a duel as a young man early in the 19th century. And one of his friends wrote him a letter. And I want to quote from this letter because this really underscores what I've been trying to say about the power of this code. This friend of Henry Clay's wrote him and said, obviously, Clay survived the duel. He wrote Clay and he said, "Your firmness and courage is now admitted by all parties." Then this friend came to the heart of the Southern view of the duel. He said, "I had rather heard of your death," he informed Clay, "than to have heard of your backing in the smallest degree." But this man was not an apostle of dueling, this friend of Henry Clay's. On the contrary, he said he disapproved of dueling in general, but, and here's this great but it seems absolutely necessary sometimes for a man's dignity. A dignity, honor, same difference. It's absolutely essential for a man's honor, for a man's dignity, that he stand for his reputation. I think now I ought to stop, and before I go to specific examples of duels, give you a chance to ask any questions if you have any. Okay. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at three duels. The first one I'm going to spend some time on because we have an eyewitness record of this that's unusual. The eyewitness account is by one of the duelists. Obviously, give away the story, he survived. But the eyewitness account is so complete. It's not just about the fighting of the duel, that's there too, but it's about how it came about. Now, before I get to the actual description, I've got to spend just a second giving them a bit of context. We haven't talked much about politics thus far in the course, and that's really for the next part of the course. And we'll be talking about the nullification controversy in some detail then. But suffice it to say for now, the nullification controversy broke out in 1832 and 33 between South Carolina and the United States of America, between the federal government and the state of South Carolina. It had to do with the tariff, the protective tariff, the tariff laws that some in South Carolina thought really infringed upon the rights of the state and also were very detrimental to the economic health of the state. And those in South Carolina who really opposed this tariff were called nullifiers. And they wanted the direct confrontation between the state and the federal government. They were willing to fight to get the tariff law repealed. Everybody in South Carolina was not a nullifier. There were those who opposed the nullifiers. They were called unionists. And the two parties fought bitterly politically. Now, I don't mean with guns. Fought bitterly in the state. The nullifiers outnumbered the unionists, but the unionists were prominent. They had prominent men in the union party. They had newspapers on each side. And what we're going to deal with now two newspaper editors in the little town of Greenville, South Carolina. Now the names, you don't know the names, and the names will never come up again in this course, but I want to use the names. One of the men is Benjamin Perry, one of the men is Turner Baum. They're two young men, newspaper editors. Perry edits a nullifying paper, Bynum edits a union paper. And first I want to quote, and I want you to listen a bit, I want to quote a paragraph from one of Bynum's editorials. I want you to listen because this paragraph is what gets Benjamin Perry all exercised. Now he says, Bynum does in his editorial, and I'm quoting, "Let the people be upon the guard. You have to contend against fearful odds," that is, against the power of the federal government. "And the more fearful because the enemy comes to you with a lure and not a threat, with a pretended alleviation of your evils under the false name of compromise." See, Perry and the Union said, we've got to have a compromise with the federal government. We don't want to have any real conflict. It comes with a fatal lure of compromise, when it is in reality a tenfold greater oppression. Now, if you are oppressed, you're pushed down into dependence. And what is worse, you have within your own camp, wearing your uniform, giving your own countersign, states' right, and crying your own watchword, union, the liege vassals of your sworn enemies. Now, see, unionists claim that they offer states' rights and the union. Well, nullifiers claim they offer states' rights and their particular vision of the Union. So you see, Bynum is telling his readers that watch out, because you've got people in our midst, right here, who talk about states' rights and Union, but they're your sworn enemies. Bynum goes on to say, "Be vigilant. Be instant in season and out of season. Let not the lulling voice of a treacherous Delilah close your watchful eyes. Be not deceived by the delusion of compromise. The lips of the ravisher are full of seductive sweetness. The serpent wooed Eve to commit sin by a tempting lie. And the monopolist and their confederates and apologists here would lead you to inevitable slavery by offering to bind upon your arms what they deceitfully call bracelets of gold, but which, if you needlessly accept, will be found shackles of iron." Now, slavery, shackles of iron. Thus, Bynum is saying, if you listen to these unionists, you're going to become slaves. You're going to become slaves. You will just be like slaves. Now, Benjamin Perry kept a diary. He read this editorial. Here's how he reacted. He said, "I was greatly shocked when I saw his editorial, for it came upon me like a clap of thunder in a clear sky. It was so unprovoked and so uncalled for, I thought it was written expressly to bring about a difficulty. Immediately, after reading the article without seeing a human being or hearing a word said in reference to the article, I sat down and wrote a note to him, saying I was not disposed to band epithets with him, but his editorial required me to demand of him the satisfaction usually among gentlemen. Angry. Sits down, I'm going to get you." But then what does he do? He calls for a friend. Wants the friend to take the note to Bynum. See, somebody else gets involved now. It's a chance to mediate. Not just anger and slap somebody side the head. It's a chance to mediate. Friend goes to Bynum. Bynum retracts nothing. Bynum retracts nothing. A duel is arranged. A duel is arranged. Now we have from Perry an account of the duel. Now Greenville in South Carolina is, I'm sure you all know, is the northwestern part of the state up here, foothills of the mountains. To fight this duel, they went to the river separating South Carolina from Georgia, and the affair was held on an island in the middle of the river, so it would be out of state. would be out of the state. Here's Perry's account. I drove slowly early in the morning. I got to the island. I was there about a half hour. Then, a few minutes before the time of combat, I got up and generally exercised and walking to and fro. My mind was kept constantly on the object in view. I thought of nothing else. I was cool. I was firm. And I was collected. Never more so in my life. Now, of course, he wrote this after the fact. Whether he was this cool and collected, we'll never know. That's what he says. We were ordered to take our places. We both approached the parts with firmness and promptness. We steadied ourselves and looked to see if we were in the proper direction. Now, when you fought these duels, you stood in profile like this. I faced you, and the person facing me would be standing just like I face. And your weapons were usually either down here or up here, until the seconds who were in charge of the event would say to point your weapons. Now, the seconds had a very important task. Not only had they arranged the affair and tried to mediate in most cases, but they also stood there to make sure the rules were followed. And the critical rule was, when the order to fire came, if you fired and you did not hit your opponent, you had to stand there for him to fire. If you bolted or ducked or ran, the seconds were supposed to shoot you down. Of course, if you did that, you would be branded such a coward, you would probably never stop running until you reached the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean or whichever one you could get to. And there are accounts of these things that are really amazing. You take Andrew Jackson, for example. Andrew Jackson fought a duel early in the 19th century against a man who was reputed to be the best shot in the Nashville area. And Jackson and his opponent went up to fight in southern Kentucky across the state line. Andrew Jackson was a tall man, but a very spare man. And the day of the duel, he wore a big shirt and cloak. And he stood like this, facing his opponent. And Jackson said to himself, he said, "That man is a better shot than me." He says, "If I get there and I get nervous and anxious and rush my shot, I'll probably miss, and I'm a goner." So Jackson consciously decided to stand there and take the first shot. He thought that was the only way he could prevail. So Jackson stood. His opponent shot. The bullet went right across here through Jackson's cloak. Jackson's opponent was amazed. Jackson was still standing. Jackson then took his pistol and shot the man dead. But he was willing to risk everything to make sure to do what he thought was best in terms of prevailing in this contest. Now notice these two men. As they are standing facing one another, Perry says, "I thought Bonham looked unusually pale. I don't know how I looked, but I felt remarkably well, not the least affrighted or intimidated." Again, this is after the fact. "I felt no sort of excitement. Our pistols were handed to us perpendicular, like this. The word was asked by my second, 'Are you ready?' I had my pistol ranging in a direct line with his body. I locked about as high as his waist. A word, fire, was pronounced. And often after the word fire, they would start counting. And both men would have fired by the time you get to whatever number they agreed upon, usually something like 3, no more than 5. Bonham fired at the word 1. His ball passed through the lapels of my coat, from the frill of my shirt and the corner of my waistcoat, passed about an inch and a half from my skin. I was in the act of taking sight when Bynum fired. Now, Perry had not planned like Jackson did to fire second. Bynum just fired first. Perry had not planned. Bynum fired first. Then Perry says, his shot confused me a little bit. Understandably. But I soon recovered. I regained my sight. And at the word two, I fired. My ball passed through his body just above the hips. Went in here, just above the hips. And broke two fingers as it came out the other side, because standing like this, ball comes in here and comes back here. It breaks his two fingers. He says, he reeled to the right. Bynum reeled to the right, dropped his pistol, and was caught by his friends. My surgeon ran up. He thought that Bynum had hit me. I did so and looked and saw I was not touched. I inquired where Bynum was hit, and he told him and was told in the thigh. I thought this was a mistake. I then went to my carriage and sent to know if I might be allowed to speak with him, after hearing that if he was in all probability mortally wounded. Permission was given, and I went up and addressed him. Now, these men had just fired at each other. And Bynum was hit. He was desperately wounded. And what does Perry say when he walks up to him? Good morning, Mr. Bynum. Bynum returns the salutation, good morning, Mr. Perry. And then Perry said, I hope to God you may recover. Bynum thanked me and said, I think I shall. I do not believe the wound fatal. I was much affected and turned off. He was lying on his side, stripped naked, the wound exposed to my view. I sent him word by my second that I had buried all bad feelings with the fire of my pistol. He sent back that he had no bad feelings against me. I left the island for my father's, 15 miles above the river. And of course, Turner Bynum died. But you notice the formality of it all. Even after the pistols had been fired, the way these two men addressed each other was all about a public display of a private quality. You don't seek your revenge in the dark. No matter how you decide to go about it, when you read Ode of Verbena, you will see that young Bayard-Sawris went out in the open of day where everybody could see him to do what he intended to do. Though what he did was not what people expected, they ended up respecting him very much for what he did do. But again, a public display of a private quality. At the same time, I've got to be honest with you. Every duel is not fought with such civility, if you can call such violent acts civil acts. Give you two more examples. But again, notice the people involved and how these occasions come about. It was election time in Mississippi in 1836. The little town of Clinton, just west of Jackson. A candidate for the Senate stood up on a table and began to speak to the crowd. In the crowd, a man hissed him. Hissed. That's the verb they use, hiss. H-I-S-S-E-D. Hissed him. The speaker's former law partner, also in the crowd, challenged the hisser to a duel right there on the spot. Seconds were quickly called in. This is almost just anger, venting anger on the spot. And what did these people do? They didn't wait. Each man was handed four pistols. They were separated by 30 paces and given the privilege of advancing. The ready was called. The start was called. The two men began going toward each other, shooting their pistols. It looked like gunfight at OK Corral. One of them was killed, one of them was severely wounded, and died about a year later. This was not exactly the kind of duel that John L. Wilson had in mind. Not exactly the kind of duel John L. Wilson, but this kind of duel did occur. The third example took place in Louisiana in 1843. And here we've got a candidate for Congress and a newspaper editor. The editor of a Baton Rouge newspaper, he was a Whig. The parties were the Whig Party and the Democrat Party. He was a Whig. And he condemned the Democratic candidate for Congress. What did he call him? Listen to this now. He called him destitute of spirit and manhood. Pretty awful, don't you think? Destitute of spirit and manhood. But now think of the social context. Who wants to be told they're destitute of manhood in a slave society? This candidate was deeply offended. This candidate was determined that he wouldn't let this just go past. Not very long afterward, the two men met again. They met again in the billiard room of a hotel in New Orleans. The candidate came up to the editor and demanded what he called reparations for your gross insult. The candidate received what he called a defiant reply. So what did he do? He picked up a billiard cue and smashed him across the head. This is not the end of it. Now, this first blow, as it were, only a preface. Then seconds came and a duel was arranged. The duel was arranged even though the editor was still partially disabled from being struck by the billiard cue. Now, these two men were placed 40 paces apart. They were armed with double-barrel shotguns. They faced each other. Each man fired one time. The body was hit. The seconds came forward, and this is what seconds are supposed to do. They come forward and say, they tell each man, you have proved your manhood. You have proved that you're an honorable person. Let's get this past us now. We don't have to go through this anymore. Nobody has to be hurt. These two men said no. Shotguns now. They fired a second time. Nobody was hurt. The seconds come up again and say, look now, this is twice. Let's put this past us. You have proved everything you need to prove. Nothing else you need to prove. Both men rejected. They fired a third time. This time the skull of the newspaper editor was grazed. Once more the seconds come forward. Again, you've proved all you need to prove. This is enough. No! Reject. A fourth time. This time the newspaper editor was killed. Now just think about powerful kind of code would have two people stand and do what these two men did. Not just with little pistols, but shotguns. Shotguns. Now, how many duels occurred? There's no way to know. There's no count of duels. How do you find out about them? You know, newspapers would note them. They would say that somebody has fought a duel, a duel has been fought. You see them in private, you see mentions of them in private correspondence. Because of the prominence of individuals involved, they would get in the newspapers. And much of the correspondence from these people has survived, so you learn about them. In the case, the one I spent so much time on, Perry and Bynum, Perry kept a journal and a diary, all of which survived, so you see a lot about that one. But there's absolutely no way to count them, to say there were 40 a year or 200 a year. But to be precise about the numbers, I don't think is necessary. To make my point that they were fought over time, they were fought by prominent people, and they gave expression to a very powerful force in the community. To a very powerful force in the community. In addition to the duels, you can find so many mentions of near duels, of duels that are averted at the last moment. It was something that was in the society. It permeated society. It pervaded the society. Any questions about the duel? Any at all? Any questions about the duel? You want to see, yes, ma'am.
Besides the code of honor, the pamphlet, was there ever almost an outline of how many paces they had to stand away from each other?
Oh, no, the seconds settled that. Okay. I mean, it was an individual thing. Like the seconds would settle that. Weapons, usually the man who was challenged got to choose the weapon. You know, you think of duels with swords under oak trees. Well, you never say that never happened, but that was not common. That was not common. But the seconds would arrange the particulars. The basic rules that were set down were how you issued challenges and how the wording of the challenge was supposed to be. But the seconds set up all the details. Okay? If you want to, yes?
I was under the impression that dueling pistols, a certain kind of pistol was used for duels that are only meant to harm, not to kill. Were they just not used in these instances? Because I know they would be shot to kill. But normally it wasn't like that.
I can't say normal. As I told you in the first class, any question you ask me, my answer will be, of course, it's a possibility. Mm-hmm. But most duels that I know about, people were in their thing, their business. Now, you might have the duel I mentioned between the Secretary of State and the Senator. The Senator shot up in the air. He never meant to hurt anybody. But he put his pistol up and shot up in the air. But there were dueling pistols. And certainly duels were fought with these pistols, but that does not mean that all duels were. In fact, there's no way to know. Mm-hmm. There's no way to know. But most accounts you have, they don't have special pistols. Yes?
So when they said fire, they fired at the same time, right?
Well, they could. Well, if they would say fire and they would count, you'd have one, two, three, and you could fire whenever you chose. So, like Jackson, he purposed in that particular duel, he said, I'm going to stand there and let the other man shoot first.
Right.
Because if I rush, I'll miss and I'm gone.
Okay.
But again, you might shoot just at the word fire. The rules were specific. It was duel-specific rules, I should say. If you want to see a concrete example of something, right over here on the south end of the campus, right off Highland Road, the next street in off Parker is a little street called Oxford Avenue. There's an old cemetery in there. In that cemetery, there's a gravestone. A man said the gravestone said he was killed in a duel. He was a judge. He was killed by another judge. They fought right across the state line in Mississippi. All this is on the headstone. All this is on the headstone. Again, judges, prominent people, people that the public would be aware of what they were doing. Anything else? Yes. It came a southern thing after the Burr Hamilton duel. Prior to that time, it was not particularly southern. There weren't that many duels. I mean, I'm not trying to say duels were on every corner. But after the Burr Hamilton duel, they really disappeared from the north. And what you have to do is explain why the duels occurred in the south. And we're going to get to that in a minute in terms of at least why I think they did. Because you'll see them disappearing in the south as well after the Civil War. Anything else? Okay. Now, Duels generally involved prominent people, not always a United States senator or a secretary of state, but a judge, a newspaper editor, a politician, a candidate for office. But if this code has the social force that I'm maintaining, it has to go beyond this group of people, this group at the top. It's got to pervade the whole society. It's got to go down through the society. And I think that I can demonstrate that, in fact, it does go down through the society. Start with our old friend Daniel Hunley. I cited old friend Daniel Hunley on so many different occasions. Hunley said in his book, Social Relations in Our Southern States, I remember Hunley was a Southerner who lived in the North. Hunley said that the men in the middle order of Southern society, the yeomen, the common white people, possessed what he called the stoutest independence, and would never allow themselves to be humiliated by anyone. Stoutest independence, that's Hunley's phrase. Never be humiliated. That's Hunley's phrase, humiliate. They will never be shamed. They're going to maintain their independence. They're going to be honorable people. And humiliation, again, is public. Hunley says no, they won't allow it. Second example, in the antebellum years, many travelers from Europe came through the South looking at the society, commenting on the society. One of these travelers was a Scotsman who paid particular attention to what he called men of business and mechanics. Now, the word mechanic to us is a very sort of job-specific thing, a person who works on engines. But the word mechanic in the middle of the 19th century meant anybody who sort of worked with his hands was a mechanic. This traveler was very interested in men of business and mechanics. And he was convinced that Southern men of business and mechanics, more than their Northern counterparts, considered themselves men of honor and more frequently resented any indignity shown to them, even at the expense of their life or that of those who ventured to insult them. The same kind of social force. The very same. Hunley, and a European traveler, but I think the best example of all to make my point comes from Augustus Longstreet. Remember, I talked about Longstreet last time and his book, Georgia Scenes. This book, Georgia Scenes, is a compilation of stories about common whites in eastern Georgia. And he talked about different kinds of things that white people, the common whites, were involved in, market days, weddings, etc. The humorous stories, as I told you. But one of his stories is entitled The Fight. And The Fight is a story that takes place on a market day in a rural Georgia county. The farmers in the surrounding countryside have come to market day. And at the end of the day, they get ready to go home. Two protagonists in this story, one is a man named Bob Durham, one is a man named Billy Stallings. Now, they're fictional characters. And they're not important, except I'm going to be using their name when I read from the story, and I don't want to confuse you. These two men had been at the courthouse watching a parade of the regimental militia, and they got ready to go home, and the two women, both men were married, the two women decided before they left the village to head back to their farms, they needed something in the local store. So they both went into the store. Now here we go. "Have you any turkey red?" says Mrs. Stallings. "Have you any curtain calico?" says Mrs. Durham at the same moment. "Yes, lady," says the storekeeper, "I have both." Then help me first, says Mrs. Durham, for I'm in a hurry. I'm in as great a hurry as she is, says Mrs. Stallings, and I'll thank you to help me first. And then Mrs. Durham says, and pray, who are you, madam? The reply comes, your betters, madam. At this moment, Billy Stallings comes in the store. He says, come, Nancy, let's be going, it's getting late. Mrs. Stallings replies, I'd have been gone a half an hour ago if it hadn't been for that impudent hussy. Mrs. Durham rose to the occasion. Who do you call impotent hussy, you nasty, good-for-nothing, snaggletooth, gob of fat you? Billy Stallings hears all this. He says, look here, woman. Have you got a husband? If you have, I'll lick him till he learns to teach you better manners, you sassy heifer, you. At this moment, a male customer in the store ran out to find Bob Durham and said to Bob Durham that he better get over there. He was told, Bob Durham, you'd better go yonder and take care of your wife. They're playing hell with her there in the store. Dot eternally dawn, my soul. If any man was to talk to my wife, it's Billy Stallings. He's talking to yours. If I wouldn't drive blue blazes through him in less than no time. Bob sprang to the store in a minute, followed by a crowd. As he enters the store, Bob says, Bill Stallings, what have you done saying to my wife? What have you been saying to my wife? Billy Stallings, surprised, says, is that your wife? Stallings responds, yes, she is, and no man shall abuse her. I don't care who he is. Now listen to Stallings' response. Listen to his response. Well, it ain't worth a while to go over it. I've said enough for a fight, and if you'll step outside, we'll settle it. He knew that he had insulted the woman and by her insulted the man. So when the man comes and challenges him, he says, why argue? I've said it. We go out, and then Longstreet describes the fight, you know, punching in eyes, pulling noses, biting, that sort of thing. It's not dueling pistols on oak trees, anything like that. It's just a massive fist fight. Well, it's just not more than fist. It's just, what do they call it now, these martial arts things, whatever. Everything goes. But you notice the way it's pitched. I mean, the way it's framed. One man insults. The next man won't allow it. The first man, being called, says, yes, I've done it. There they go. There they go. There they go. Now, duels don't really last in Southern history after the Civil War. You find one or two here and there that are accounted for, but not very many. And why is that, you think? Is it because white Southerners all of a sudden became less violent? Because white Southerners all of a sudden somehow decided that, well, this dueling was something that we shouldn't engage in anymore? I think not. I think because the duel was absolutely critically a part of a slave society. When slavery no longer existed, no man could be put in the same position as a slave. No white man could be called slave-like. A man might be humiliated. A man might be condemned. A man might even be shamed, but it wouldn't be that he's ending up on the level of a slave. And so you have the duel. It doesn't go down on like this. It just sort of falls off a cliff. One or two isolated episodes here and there. It is a part of the slave society. Its meaning is all about its context. And it's critically important to see that it goes below the top, as I said. It comes down through the whole society. It comes down through the whole society. Witness Hundley's comment. Witness the traveler's comment. Witness Augustus Longstreet's story. Now, do you have any questions or comments about number three before I conclude? Anything about number three? Now, we've been talking about individuals reacting to other individuals. But the individual reaction is to maintain an individual status, not only with himself, within his own heart, his own mind, but within his community. Now, suppose we go from the individual to the entire community. And a community begins to feel insult. A community begins to feel humiliation. A community begins to feel that it is being shamed. How does the community react? When political opponents of the South start in the 1830s and build through the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, opponents of the South who just don't say that we want to beat Southerners in politics, but talk about the South as un-American, talk about the South as un-Christian, talk about the South as a moral blot on the nation. Talk about slavery as immoral and undermining what America stands for. When overwhelmingly white Southerners, slavery is something that they might not think is a good, but is something that they don't know how to live without, cannot imagine living without. And this attack builds and builds and builds until Southerners are branded in the eyes of many as un-American, as un-Christian, as immoral, as holding on to a barbarous institution, an institution that mocks the meaning of America. Then this South, this community of the South, is being hit in the face with the same kinds of assaults that stirred Benjamin Perry, that stirred the congressional candidate, that stirred Stallings and Durham, to say no, to fight back. Now, am I saying that the secession, the Civil War came about because of the code, because of the concept of honor? No. It's much more complicated than that. But at the same time, you cannot simply dismiss this code. And the way Southerners felt about the attacks on them. You look at the manuscript record, it's clear Southerners kept talking about the humiliation that was trying to be heaped upon them. Southerners kept talking about their determination to be an equal. They would not be slave-like. So no, this is not cause. But this is certainly there. It's certainly on the minds of Southerners. It's in the hearts of Southerners. And it is in the language that Southerners use to express what they feel about the situation that they find themselves in. And of course, the situation they find themselves in the middle of the 19th century has all to do with the institution of slavery. Duels, yes, they're only restricted to the South, likewise slavery. Before the American Revolution, as we've talked about, slavery was legal in all the 13 British colonies. But in the aftermath of the Revolution, slavery was ended in all the states above the Mason-Dixon line. Usually it was done gradually over time, but it was on the way out. But below the line, no. And in fact, the Revolution is crucial. The Revolution is crucial because in the Revolution, when Americans fought for liberty, Americans in the southern states were full well aware that they fought for liberty while holding slaves. And what about the Revolution and slavery? Well, next time we'll start dealing with that, and slavery comes out of the Revolution even stronger than it went in, I would argue. Because before the Revolution, people didn't really think about slavery, didn't talk about it very much. It was just there. But the language of the revolution, freedom and slavery, liberty and enslavement, institutionalized everybody's mind. But when it comes through that cauldron, it comes through intact, then Southerners have made a powerful decision. We'll begin talking about that on next Tuesday. Thank you very much. If you've got any more questions, please come up and ask them.
Next week on Lectures in History, Professor Melissa Harris-Perry talks about first ladies in U.S. history, with a focus on Betty Ford. The class is from Tulane University in New Orleans. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.